And I should make a disclaimer, because as Richard explained, so my PhD is in statistical physics. I've done postdocs in applied math and theoretical computer science. And now I'm a professor of mechanical engineering. So especially for people who are more like postdocs in the room, I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity from your training in physics. And you know, there's a lot of potential and chances to move forward. So we don't always end up in the most obvious places, but it's definitely great training and has been for me. And I'm also external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute, which is an institute that studies complex systems. So what is a complex system? So complex systems are not very well defined. They're basically characteristics that we can say about complex systems. They tend to have many length scales and many time scales involved in them. They can have irregular connectivity, so they're normally not systems like lattices where you have a well-defined coordination number and everyone interacts with neighbors. They usually have very irregular patterns of connectivity that are often well described by networks of who interacts with whom, what atoms interact with what atoms, et cetera. And one of the signatures of complex systems is really that they have emergent behaviors. So what is an emergent behavior? Well, it's a collective phenomena, so it's something that happens from a collection of simple things that wouldn't be described just from the equations of that simple thing. So the classic examples are self-organization, so forming patterns, forming order in a decentralized manner, and also things like phase transitions, where you see abrupt changes in a system's properties in response to a slim change in an external control parameter. So that's sort of the characteristic of complex systems, but there's so many systems that fall in this realm. And I'm gonna talk to you a little bit today about my journey through complex systems. So it kind of started with my PhD research, which was on thermodynamics and computing, and I was interested in how to form order consistent with the second law of thermodynamics, and how you might map growing structures onto digital logic and do computation with them. And then I started getting interested in networks and phase transitions, and ultimately, right now, I've also been trying to connect a lot of ideas to engineered systems, biological systems, and economics. So I probably won't get into that, but I'll talk to you a lot about some of these ideas about self-organization and phase transitions. And like I was saying, my training sort of falls in these four areas. So statistical physics, computer science, probability, and computer simulation, which is certainly very distinct from computer science. So computer scientists are very good at building algorithms and analyzing their properties, but maybe not so much at actually analyzing numerical data from experiments. So there's a rich interplay between these fields, which I'll talk to you a little bit about. And they share a lot in common. So a lot of the things that they share in common are like phase transitions that we see. I'll talk a little bit about phase transitions in computer science. They're also unified by some of the same theoretical ideas. So ideas of percolation let us make progress in all these realms. And things like computational complexity classes are helping us make progress. When we go out from towards the lattice, sorry, when we go out towards the statistical physics axis, we normally end up with lattice models. And these models are studied by all these different fields. They might call them slightly different names. They might have different goals and motivations, but they study many of the same models. And when we go out more towards the computer science axis, we end up with network models. And how did I get into this? Well, I think that statistical physics has a lot to offer towards thinking about computer systems and networked systems. One of the things that's tantamount in physics is that we have locality, so we don't have action at a distance. So what does locality translate into a system? Well, it would be decentralized control. And also self-organization would let a system grow, to have scalable growth, so it can continue growing without having more overhead or a necessity for central control. And one of the things that we study a lot in statistical physics are scaling behaviors. So how do fluctuations and correlations grow from the microscopic to the macroscopic? And that's incredibly important in many systems to try and provision for future growth, try and understand the range of phenomena that you're going to be dealing with. So a lot of the techniques that come from physics translate naturally into thinking about networking and algorithms. So I'm going to talk to you mostly today about networks. So what is a network? A network is an abstract object, and it can be manifested into many real-world systems. But at an abstract level, a network is a collection of nodes or vertices, so discrete entities, that are connected together by some kind of relationship. So I thought I'd start out by showing you some pictures of networks in different realms. So these are social networks. So here the nodes are individual people, and the links mean that there's some relationship between them. And one of the important areas about social networks is trying to understand things like immunology. So how does disease flow over networks of human contacts? And people are very interested in like viral marketing. How do you get ideas to be adopted? A lot of it also relates to cultural evolution and even genetic evolution, looking at how populations interact with each other. So this is, like I said, people, edges represent a relationship between them. And this is actually a network of who dated who in high school. So pink nodes are girls, blue nodes are boys, edge means that they dated. And this is sort of an analogous idea of adults. So this was commissioned by the Center for Disease Control, and they were interested in sexual contact networks of high-risk HIV users. So here the size of the node is proportional to its degree, where degree means how many edges are incident from that node. And I'll talk to you about node degree a little bit. So, so again, we're really interested in understanding flow over human contact networks. This is the internet. So what is the internet? Well, many different levels of representation, and we could spend an hour talking about just what the internet is. But this is looking sort of at an abstract image of the physical layer. So what is the physical layer of the internet? Well, here the nodes are routers, and edges mean that there's physical cable actually connecting these two routers. And the colors on here are what geographic region those routers are located in. So Europe, US, Africa, et cetera, the colorings. And of course, one of the things for the internet is that we want it to be robust to failure. So we want some edges to be able to go down and not destroy large-scale connectivity. So maintaining large-scale connectivity is one of the fundamental things that we need to do. We're also interested in provisioning for future growth, trying to understand how's the internet scaling, what do we need to do to provide the necessary structures that will be there. And also, we need really good models to generate topologies of the internet, topologies that look similar to the internet, so that we can test protocols on them and do experiments in the lab on sample topologies of the internet. So obviously, you can't go and deploy a new protocol on the internet itself. You have to do it in a testbed kind of area. So that's one of the reasons why we're very interested in coming up with good models that tell us about the topology of the internet. This is a World Wide Web picture. So here, the nodes are web pages. And an edge means that one page has a link to another page. So you can see these are now directed. Up until now, all the relationships have been equal in both ways. But here, a link from one page doesn't mean that you have to have a backwards link. And again, the internet and the World Wide Web are very different things. So the internet is the physical structure of routers and cables. The World Wide Web is an application layer that lives on top and runs on top of the internet. So there's an interacting stack of networks that coordinate to, you know, bring us the technology that we have, but they're very different entities. So you can think about it because in the picture of the physical layer, an edge has a metric and it has a cost associated with it that scales with that metric, right? So if I want to lay a cable from Waterloo to China, it's pretty expensive. In the other realm, which is virtual, a link from a web page in Waterloo to one in China has no more cost than Waterloo to Toronto. So very different constraints when we start looking at virtual versus physical networks. Another physical network that I've been studying a lot is the airline network. So here we're interested in optimizing route structures. It would also be nice if we could make scheduling a little bit more dynamic. So these are sort of some of the problems that people have been looking at. And I've been working with some of my students looking at how the actual physical airline network, so looking at the passenger carriers in the US and trying to understand what their topologies are like, how they're similar, how they're different. So these are most of the standard carriers. And this guy is Southwest. And it's looking at how densely interconnected it is by a measure called K-coreness, which I won't really get into. And then we were looking also at the resilience to random edges. And Southwest is just much more resilient. So we're trying to look at physical systems as well and get some lessons for design principles. That's a continental wrap up. Yeah. And again, this is a physical network, right? So each node has an actual GPS position. It's
Is Southwest so different because they have somebody doing this inside?
They
have somebody doing this inside of the
planet? You know, there's so many reasons, and it's hard to tease out like what is physical advantage and what's an economic policy decision that they made that was really good. So Southwest has studied in so many realms, like at the business schools, because they've just been very broad-minded. They started out trying to be better than the bus. So that was their motto. And they also started only in Texas, so they had no interstate regulations that they had to deal with. So they started in one state. To me, I think that they just try to minimize variance. They don't like variance at all. So they were very successful last year because they had hedged their fuel prices for the next 15 years. Oh. So they're not looking so smart now, but a year ago they were looking brilliant to have minimized that. So I think they like to fly where there's very little traffic and weather that's going to interfere with their routing. Mm-hmm. And their sort of mode has been to minimize variance.
But their key difference is that they have no hubs.
They
do a lot of flights that just stop.
Yeah, so they have sort of like mini hubs. So if you define a hub by its degree, Southwest actually has many hubs that are interconnected together. And they make sure to link their hubs together. So it's unlike most airlines where hubs would never connect.
Like that.
Like Continental. Yeah. Yeah, and there's so many problems in the airline trying to understand because there's so many levels of detail. Scheduling, airport gates, all these economic considerations as well. And so many of these carriers have international flights that they have to worry about.
Right.
And Southwest doesn't.
Have you done similar comparisons for other countries and then compared?
I haven't, no. So we just started this a few months ago and are trying to understand what it actually means, how to tease out topology from economic layers, et cetera. That would be an interesting idea.
I would be interested by that as well, because what you said about weather, flying where there's no sort of dodgy weather conditions was interesting, because Australia is about geographically the same size as the US. It has far fewer nodes because it's much less densely populated, but it also has much more stable weather conditions, much clearer air. It would be interesting to see as like a comparison between various countries.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. Sorry, but I want to move on.
There's also, you can study the evolution because the Department of Transportation maintains databases, so you can look at how they've evolved over time, which is one of the things we'll do next. And another system that I work with a lot is software. So there's a lot of networks and software, and there's many different layers of them. So software, especially open source software, is one of the things we've been working on. And part of why we're interested in it, because there's all this data that we can get for free. And another thing about open source software is it's very modular. So people all over the world contribute and can extend it. So it's very easily extendable, it's very modular, and it can be very robust to certain kinds of bugs because it is modular, so they can be isolated. And open source software exhibits punctuated equilibrium, which is also called refactoring in the computer world. So it has periods of growth where more functions are being added, and it keeps on increasing in complexity, but it suddenly gets so unwieldy that they have to step back and rewrite all the code structure. So that's a refactoring event. So it goes through these punctuated periods where it's growing and growing, and then it gets re-streamlined, and then it keeps growing and gets streamlined. So there's some analogies that we're making to biological systems. So and we have all this accessible data. So that's really one of the reasons. And there's several different networks in there. So we can look at the calls between functions. So we can look at nodes as being functions and edges as being one function calls another. And this is a picture here of one of the meshes of functions calling each other. So it's looking at sort of potential information flows. We also have access to email communication, so we have a social network amongst the developers, so who talks to who, and we're really interested in socio-technical congruence, trying to connect those two. So how does the social interaction relate to the technical structure of the code? And another network that I'm studying a lot is biological networks. So biological networks are just fascinating because there's so many levels of networks in there that interact. So here's just a little schematic. So I guess I need my hockey stick pointer now. Very Canadian. So we start out at the genome level, and genes get activated, and they give rise to proteins, and the proteins interact with each other, and then they go back to the genetic level and inhibit or activate other proteins, the same way that proteins interact to give rise to metabolites and volatile organic compounds that we see emitted. So there's all these layers of interacting networks in biological systems, and we have a team that we put together with labs that are specialized in each of those layers. And my job is supposed to be to find statistical signatures between healthy individuals and diseased individuals for biomarkers for early detection of disease. So this is a project that we just started. And I don't know how I got roped into
doing this really difficult thing of finding biomarkers, but it's a very intriguing problem. Up until now, people have studied biological systems just at the genome level, the protein level, or the metabolic level. So trying to tie it all together is really exciting. So we actually have a IT specialist whose job is to integrate all the data and build a big cloud computing server where everything will be there. So it's a pretty exciting opportunity. So these are all different kinds of networks, right? I'm more of a physicist, so I'm not so interested that much in the actual real-world networks. I'm sort of interested in trying to understand models that will let us make progress on many different kinds of networks and then connecting them. So we saw these pictures of networks. How do you represent a network as a mathematical object so that we can do some analytic work on it? So you guys probably have a good answer to that. And that's just having a matrix which tells us about connectivity. So this is the adjacency matrix. And it is, if you have n nodes, it's n by n. And one means that there's an edge from one node to another. Zero means that there's no connection. What I drew here was symmetric. So nodes, the edges go both ways. So it's symmetric across a diagonal, but it doesn't need to be. If it's a directed network, it wouldn't be. And here I just drew a picture of a network, and I drew its matrix representation. And if we count down the number of ones in each column, it tells me the degree of that particular node. Right, so node one has four edges, and you can see in the picture node one has four edges, including a self loop in this case. And that's the degree, and I'm going to talk a lot about degree. And just from this matrix, from the topology, we can get a lot of other properties as well. So people have been studying many things like diameters of graphs, how clustered they are, things about whether high degree nodes connect to high degree nodes, and measures of importance in networks. So there's been a lot of progress made on studying topology of networks. And that's been mostly from the physics point of view. But more from the computer science perspective, people are more interested in information flows on networks. They're not so interested in the actual topology and structure. And one of the things that makes it very difficult to connect topology and structure, especially in things like computer systems, is that you have a lot of routing protocols that can circumvent that topology. So it's hard to tease out the interactions between topology and function, but it's certainly a major area where people are trying to make progress. So we're interested in looking at flows on networks as well. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to think about a random walk on the network topology. So here I just have a picture of that same network, and I have a random walker, which is red. And it's going to be a discrete time process. So at each time, it has some chance of hopping to one of its neighbors. And I decided for this instance that it's going to do it in an unbiased manner. So it's just going to follow and hop to each of its neighbors with equal probability. So it's at node two, and at the next time step, they'll have probability a third to stay put, probability a third to flow to node one, probability a third to flow to node four. So if I look at the column corresponding to node two, I see that it's the random walk state transition probabilities. And this is actually called the state transition matrix. And we can, the matrix tells us a lot of information. So the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the matrix give us tremendous amounts of information. The eigenvectors, if you think about it, so this is the state transition matrix. So we're going to start the random walker at some arbitrary point, and it's going to keep on iterating and iterating. And eventually, it's going to reach steady state, where its probabilities don't change anymore. So it's reached the stationary distribution of probabilities. And that stationary distribution of probabilities on an instance of a graph is actually the PageRank algorithm that's the foundation behind Google. So the guys at Google in 99, they were trying to understand how to rank the importance of pages in the web. So before them, search engines like AltaVista, et cetera, they would just return all the pages that were a semantic match. So they looked for your keywords, they returned all the pages that had those keywords. They didn't know how to put them into an order that would be useful to you. So what Google did is they crawled the web, they made a picture of what the World Wide Web looked like, and then they looked at random walks on that instance of the World Wide Web. And the stationary distribution of the random walker is your page rank. And that was their starting point, but it's easy to spam, so they hence evolved it quite a bit. But it was really the foundation behind it. The eigenvectors also tell us a lot about how the network breaks up into communities. Mm-hmm.
You should just the page rank, you mean the sizes of the probabilities when you order them?
Yeah. So that stationary, the eigenvector of the stationary probabilities is the page rank.
The page rank is a number, right?
The page rank is a number.
So
normalized between 0 and 1.
So what do you mean by the eigenvector?
So the eigenvector, so if I look at the value of each node in the eigenvector. And they can also tell us things about like time scales for information flows on networks. And I just drew took one example here of eigenvector decomposition. So this is a sample network. This is actually a network of books on politics in the year 2004. So each node is a book. Edges mean that they were recommended by Amazon. So when you go to Amazon, you type in a book, it says you should also be interested in these guys. So it's a recommendation network of books on politics. And we looked at the eigenvector that was not the stationary distribution, but one less than the stationary distribution. So the second largest eigenvector, which is studied often, called the Fiedler vector as well in different areas. And we looked at whether you had a positive contribution or a negative contribution. Positive contributions are colored in red, negative contributions are colored in blue, and then these guys were very close to zero. And it also shows us how the nodes break up into communities. So you can see all these guys in blue are sort of like lies and the lying liars, Bush's brain, you know, and the guys, the ones over here are like Hillary's scheme. So what does it tell us? So it tells us that all the red guys talk, all the blue guys talk, but there's very little cross-linkage between them. So networks, we see them all over. Some are geometric, some are virtual. Some are natural, like biological systems. Others are engineered, like the airline network. Each network might optimize something different, and there's some similarities and differences, and that's what we're really trying to do, is understand what are similar, what are different. Can we use that to guide future design? Can we use that to better control networks? And this is really a big question, like I was saying, the interplay of topology and function. But one of the things that we've seen that unifies all these different networks is that they have incredible range of node degrees. So degree is how many edges are incident to each node. And we'll see that there's a tremendous range of node degrees. So lots of small degree nodes and several high degree hubs. So there's not a narrow distribution. They're very broad scale distributions. That's the one thing we've found in common amongst all these networks. And this is sort of the ideas behind this field called network science. So this was a study from the Natural Research Council, which is the National Academy of Sciences of the US, their wing that's trying to guide policy. And so they had this panel that came together, and they realized that networks are studied in so many different realms, but in a very disciplinary setting. So people are working on engineering their particular network, and there hasn't been a lot of cross discipline or talk between these areas. They're kind of stovepiped. So they were calling for increased funding and this new creation of this new field. So there's really been an explosion in this network science in the last 10 years. And there, I could probably talk at length about many different things, but I really want to focus on topology, like we've talked about so far, and also some idea of phase transitions, since that's what I'm really interested in. So phase transition, so classic idea of a phase transition is the Ising model. So, you know, I studied it more from applied mathematicians, so I call it the Ising model. I know people in physics more call it the Ising model, so it depends. Sometimes I say it one way, sometimes I say it the other. Shows my schizophrenia. So what is the Ising model? So it's a two-dimensional lattice model that I'm thinking of right now. And at each site, you have a spin. It can be a plus one or a minus one. Spins interact with their nearest neighbors. So this is the Hamiltonian. I'm sure everyone's very familiar. So you sum over nearest neighbors with some coupling constant, and then there might be an external field or not. And the probability of observing a particular configuration with a particular energy at equilibrium follows the Boltzmann probability. Right? So high energy configurations, like I've drawn here, are more likely at high T. So that's the basics of the Ising model. And we see a phase transition in magnetization. So what's magnetization? It's the number of spin ups minus the number of spins down divided by the total number of spins, right? So I know this is probably well known to everybody. So at high temperature, you have no net magnetization. You reach a critical point and suddenly have a non-zero magnetization. Whether it's positive or negative depends tremendously on the fluctuations that are going on, which is why we see things like diverging susceptibilities at that critical point. And Perls gave a non-rigorous proof that this spontaneous magnetization had to exist for the 2D Ising model in 1936. And Onsager in 44 gave the complete analytic solution. So this is sort of like the prototypical phase transition that we're used to dealing with in physics. But what's interesting is that at the same time, actually slightly earlier than the Ising model was being worked out,
the foundations of mathematical epidemiology were also getting worked out, and it's a phase transition as well. So this is the classic model of Kermick and McKendrick, and it's the SIR model, susceptible, infected, and recovered. And they look at a system of three differential equations. So you have susceptible individuals, infected, and recovered, and there's some infection rate beta, where an infected person contacts a susceptible person and gives them the disease, and there's some rate of spontaneous recovery. So how does the system evolve in time? When we look at differential equations, it tells us how susceptible change with respect to time, so it's how many were there, minus how many came in contact, how many susceptible came in contact with infected, and with rate beta, they become infected and they add to the infected population. And the infected population can also spontaneously recover, so they deplete the infected population and go to the recovered population. So that system of three differential equations is what Kermack and McKendrick introduced. And I really want to point out that their mean field, in that they assume every individual is equally likely to contact any other individual. So there's no spatial structure. They're just assuming that everyone's equally likely to encounter each other. And they find that there's a phase transition. So there is a critical ratio of these parameters, infection rate, number of susceptible in the initial population, divided by the recovery rate. And when that ratio is greater than one, you get an epidemic outbreak. And it's actually a branching process. So what that means is when this ratio is greater than one, it means that an infected person infects on average more than one infected person before it recovers. So it's a branching process where the branching keeps going on indefinitely. So there's an epidemic outbreak. If this parameter is greater than one, if the parameter is less than one, the disease dies out. So there's this phase transition that they found in epidemiological systems. And of course, if we want to think about how diseases actually spread in reality, they're not mean field, right? So we're not equally likely to come into contact with anyone else in the world. Diseases actually flow over networks of human contacts. And one of the interesting things to think about is, like, what is the variance of degree? So we know that people like receptionists in big buildings come into contact with hundreds of people every day, whereas you know, the elderly don't come into contact with many people at all in a day. So there's a tremendous range of how many contacts individuals have. So one of the advances was trying to lay this SIR model onto network structures, hoping to recover what real diseases look like. This is a very open question as well, because there are two different goals that we might think of. So is our goal to minimize who gets infected, so keep the outbreak of the disease contained? Or is our goal more of what the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, their goal is to minimize death. So they don't mind having more people infected. They want to minimize how many people die. So when they immunize people, they don't necessarily think about knocking out high-degree nodes. They think about immunizing the elderly and the young, who are more likely to die if they get the disease. So it's been interesting, but there hasn't been actionable results yet from thinking about epidemiology on networks.
So without taking consideration the network structure, so those differential equations, when they are, this is ignored, they are useless, right? You're wasting an outbreak for a big enough population.
Well, you know, it's qualitative. So it's certainly...
But you cannot really use it. I mean, it's loose.
It's loose. And when
so you need to work on the network.
You do. And unfortunately, it's very sensitive to the properties of the particular network. And that's what a lot of network systems are. It's very sensitive on details. And I'll talk a little bit about some of that later on. So the ideas of trying to lay things out on networks sort of started out with random graphs. And we can ask, when with high probability will there be a giant component on a random graph? So in a graph, so here I've drawn a starting point where we're going to start with n isolated vertices. And we're going to add edges one at a time. So again, it's a discrete time process. I start with isolated nodes. I'm going to add an edge. I just choose two nodes at random and connect them. So that's how I'm doing it. It's just a random probability. And the total number of edges possible is the number of nodes times n minus 1 divided by 2, because they're undirected edges. So after I've added epsilon edges to the graph, the probability of any edge being present is just how many I've added divided by the total number that could be there. And we want to know, what does the resulting graph look like? And I should mention that these ideas were developed by Paul Erdős and Alfred Renyi. And so they're very well known for introducing the notion of random graphs. But at the same time that they were working on this, Ed Gilbert
introduced basically the same formalism. And Ed Gilbert was a mathematician working at Bell Labs, and he was really interested in cell phone connectivity. So in the late 1950s, he was trying to understand whether cell communication would be possible. So he thought about this random graph model. So we want to start out connecting edges, and we want to see, is there large-scale connectivity or is there not large-scale connectivity? So in the case of epidemiology, large-scale connectivity means a disease could reach epidemic proportions. If you don't have connectivity, you can't infect many people. So it's a nice ideal model. It's like our little toy model. And I want to know, what does the resulting graph look like? So P is my parameter, and what does the resulting graph look like? So here I've just drawn two instances. So the number of nodes is 300 in each. And here the probability P is 1 over 400. And I colored in red the largest component that was connected together. So the red is the largest component on the graph, and it's like of size 8. And I made the probability slightly higher. And I can see that the largest component spans the whole system. So what Erdős and Rennyi showed was that there was a phase transition as a function of probability P. So when P is less than a particular value, you have the largest component is minuscule. It's it's sublinear in N. I'll talk about that a little bit more. But you have just a very minuscule largest component that tends to zero. But above that phase transition point, you have a finite component that starts growing very rapidly and picking up more of the nodes available. And that critical probability happens when the probability of nodes, so critical probability is 1 over n, where n is the total number of nodes. So it means that on average, everybody has one neighbor. So it's a tree again. So as soon as you have slightly more than one neighbor, so 1 plus epsilon neighbors, you have a branching process, and the whole thing continues. So it's sort of like epidemiology as well, that we're interested in when this branching process dies out or when it continues. If it dies out, no large-scale connectivity. If it continues, large-scale connectivity. So it happens right when the probability is 1 over n.
Frontal axis, so that's the average number of degree of the
nodes? Yeah, so P is the probability, and n is the number of nodes. And I just wrote it this way because I didn't want it to depend on the size of the system. Mm-hmm. So it's a continuous phase transition. So if I look just below the transition point and just slightly above the transition point, I'm going to see that they end up being equal to each other. So the largest component, the size of it, just below and just above, tends to the same value. So mathematically, that says that the size of the largest component at TC minus epsilon is well known to scale as n to the 2/3. At TC plus epsilon, it's n to the 2/3 plus something tiny. And that something tiny scales as n to the minus 1/3. So as I get bigger and bigger, the gap between the two shrinks, and I find that it's a continuous phase transition. So that's a well-known result about the Erdős-Rennyi graph. So with a couple colleagues, we were interested in trying to perturb the Erdős-Rennyi process a little bit. So we wanted to know, is it possible to enhance the onset of connectivity or delay the onset of connectivity? So, you know, in a communication system, we probably, like the internet, we want to make sure everyone's connected. We want to enhance connectivity. In epidemiological systems, we want to delay connectivity. So we're interested in understanding how to change Erdős-Rennyi slightly to get these results. And we were studying something called the product rule. So what we're going to do now is take advantage of a theme that's come out recently in randomized algorithms. So instead of one edge at each time, so we know we can sample edges. That's the whole basis of the model. So we can sample edges. So instead of sampling one edge and accepting it, why don't we sample two edges, look at them, and take the one we like more? So what we're going to do is that exactly. So now we get two edges, and we're going to look at the size of the components that are joined by those edges. If we want to enhance connectivity, we take the one that's going to result in the largest component. If we want to delay it, we take the one that results in the smallest component. So we've sort of exploited the idea of sampling, of random sampling, and are looking at a process that has some choice. And what's interesting, so here's the standard Erdős-Rennyi in black. And if we look at the enhancing version, where we want it to grow more quickly, indeed, the onset is faster. But it looks a lot like the Erdős-Rennyi transition. So it's also a continuous transition. Far more interesting, if we take the delayed version, it appears to be a discontinuous transition. And we started trying to nail that down. So we spent like year and a half trying to nail this down, and we couldn't come up with good analytic solutions to it. So we ended up having to do numerical simulations, and we're working hard on trying to come up with a way of showing this analytically, but we haven't yet.
So now we look at the product rule, the delaying product rule. And again, I'm going to look at the size of the largest component just below the critical point and just above the critical point. And below the critical point, I find that it's sublinear in n, end of the gamma with gamma less than 1. And above the critical point, it's some finite fraction of the network, a times n. So it now has a discontinuous gap. And as we increase system size, that discontinuity keeps increasing. So the difference only gets larger as we go to larger systems, which is more proof that things are discontinuous. And we wanted to look at how big we could actually make this. So how sharp is this transition? So we know we go from sublinear to having some finite fraction. So can we get half of all the vertices? Can we make this happen instantaneously to go from no large-scale connectivity to having half of the vertices connected in time that goes to 0? And we were able to show that. So we looked at the time it takes to go from sublinear to more than half of all the vertices. And you can show that that time required goes as n to the minus 2/5. So as you get to larger and larger systems, it becomes more sharp and instantaneous. And we have found a lot of very interesting behaviors in this delayed product rule. So we can find it that happens for a range of parameters. So it goes from sublinear, n to the gamma, to 0.5n, and time that goes sublinearly in n as well. And we find some scaling behaviors as well. So we wanted to know how big we can actually make a. So we showed it for half of all the vertices. But we find that the same scaling relation between those exponents holds in this whole regime from having a tenth of the vertices to 60% of the vertices. So we know we go instantaneously to at least 60% of the vertices. Mm-hmm.
Interpret those three colors there. Now I'm surprised.
In here.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I presume the black one is when you don't do.
The black one's the classic Erdős-Rendi model.
Because you think that the delayed, two different delayed ones that.
So well, this is an enhanced one. The blue one is enhancing.
Okay, but why? I don't understand why the lines cross, because it seems like you'll always be better if you choose.
Yeah. So why that happens? So he's asking me about not at the critical points. But why does the red get larger than the black at some point, and why does the blue die out so quickly? And that's because after a while, the large component is so big, and I'm sampling edges at random. So almost all the edges I choose are already part of that component. So though that edge didn't exist yet, I'm adding it, and I don't change the size of the largest component. I change its density.
Can you describe the model a little more in detail? Are you going through the edges one by one?
We're just choosing edges at random. So we just choose two edges uniformly at random. So with the Erdős-Rendi model, you choose one edge uniformly at random and add it to the graph.
Right, but after you choose the first two, then are you taking another pair and then another
uniformly
pair,
at random.
Another pair.
Yeah.
And so it has a kind of memory as opposed
to. No, but we're just sampling randomly. There's no memory. So we're just sampling randomly and. The edge might be there already, and that happens with small probability initially and more probability later on. So we're just sampling at random two vertices. So classic Erdős-Rendi.
You do this many times over.
You do this many times over.
So what? Whether you choose a particular edge depends in some extent on whether you've chosen other edges.
So we're actually choosing nodes. So we choose two nodes and add an edge between them.
That's what
so we choose two, with Erdős-Rendi, you choose two nodes uniformly at random at each time step in the process. And there might actually be an edge there already, but then you just do nothing. And so we were able to show that this was discontinuous. And one of the things to me that's very fascinating is that it's a discontinuous transition, but we see a lot of signatures of things that we associate with continuous phase transitions, like divergent correlation lengths. So this is looking at this, how the size of the second largest component scales. And we see that it also diverges at that critical point. So we see things that are discontinuous, so they look like first order phase transitions, but they also have diverging correlation lengths, so they look like second order phase transitions. So they sort of belong to a universality class that's become very interesting in the last couple of years. So these are mixed transitions. They show some aspects of first order and some aspects of second order transitions. They were first observed in glassy systems with really slow relaxation times. And then they were observed in computer science problems. So I'll tell you about constraint satisfaction. So they're observed in constraint satisfaction problems. And these problems are sort of infinite dimensional because, like Erdős-Rendi, I'm just mixing nodes. I don't care anything about
their spatial structure. So there's no dimension in the system. But these same kinds of mixed transitions were observed recently in models of granular materials, which is far more interesting because they're finite dimensional. They're two-dimensional, three-dimensional models. So we're trying to understand if there's something that connects all these guys, since they seem to have similar universality class. And being physicists, we like to unify the stuff. So KSAT is a constraint satisfaction problem studied often in computer science. And there are a collection of n Boolean variables, so n spins that are plus or minus 1. And we're going to draw k of those n spins at random and make clauses out of them. So here's a clause. We make OR clauses, so x1 or not xj or not or xk. So here's how it looks logically. And then we're going to take a collection of mk clauses. So we build an instance of a random clause. And we want to know, is there an assignment of the x's that can make that clause true? So it's a yes-no question. And there's tremendous numbers of applications to constraint satisfaction. So one of the areas is in scheduling, trying to find Hamiltonian paths, so the most efficient path to traverse a network. With scheduling, we want to see, is there any way to make all these products simultaneously? What order do we need to do them in? And it's used a lot in optimization. And it's an NP-complete problem when k is greater than 3, which means that it's provably one of the most complicated problems to solve. And if we could find an algorithm to quickly solve this KSAT for k greater than 3, we would be able to quickly solve many other hard problems. So that's why it's important. And what we find in KSAT is that there's a phase transition as a function of the number of clauses to variables. So m is the number of clauses, n is the number of variables. So when that ratio is small, there are very few clauses and many variables. So it's easy to find a satisfying solution. Likewise, when that ratio is very large, it's easy to find that there is no satisfying solution because it's over-constrained. So you have many clauses, very few variables, so you can't solve it. And in the intermediate range, that shows some very interesting behaviors where the solutions exist, but they're very hard to find. So the green ball is the satisfying solutions, the red balls are the unsatisfying solutions. And in that intermediate regime, there's this mixed behavior. And we can also think about KSAT as a graph, as a network. So here, it's a bipartite kind of network. And the clauses are boxes, and the variables are circles. And so the variables, each clause, involves k variables. And the variables can be involved in multiple clauses. And by looking at the geometric structures of these factor graphs, trying to find local constraint chains, there were a collection of physicists who were able to come up with a really fast algorithm. So for solving KSAT, which is NP-complete, which would give us a lot of insight about how to solve hard problems quickly, the standard approach runs in order 2 to the n, where n is the number of variables. And by exploiting the locality of constraint chains in this graph representation, a collection of physicists using techniques from spin glasses were able to come up with a much faster algorithm. So it's pretty exciting. And they don't have many, these are not rigorous techniques, they're heuristic. And so there's a lot of tension between the mathematicians who try and prove things rigorously. And I mean, their algorithm works. You can show that it works. Why it works is still an open question.
It's got the RK and the RK star. And it probably doesn't sound
that in general, but only in some value of the ratio between clauses.
Yeah. And they were using spin glass techniques. So they looked at when there was a backbone, when there had to be a backbone of constraint chains, of variables that had to be the same in an ensemble of clauses. So they looked at ensemble of clauses that were more or less like each other, and they looked at when all the variables were constrained. So that's how they sort of come up with RK and the other RK star and RK.
So is it between the two RKs where that algorithm runs, or?
Yeah, it is. It is. And part of I'm just going to skip this. Okay. So part of why this is so interesting to us is that we want to know connections between these things. So hard instances, right? So this is what
you were just asking me about. So in that region between K star and K, there are very hard instances. You don't know whether you have a solution or not. So there's some questions of, can those hard instances tell us how to do things that sometimes we want really hard instances, right? So if we're doing cryptography, we want to have something that's very hard to break. So easy to solve, like an NP-complete problem. Easy to test if you are given a sample solution. very hard to find a solution if you're not given one. So there's a lot of reasons why we might want to have hard instances. And another really interesting question that's very open is things like critical slowing down and simulations of systems nearing critical points, phase transitions, and their computational complexity classes. And there was some other very interesting result that was by the same guys who had the fastest algorithm in 99. And they showed that if k is 2, so if they looked at 2 sat, they get a continuous phase transition. If they look at 3 sat, they get a discontinuous phase transition. And the other thing to me as a physicist, which strikes me as so interesting about that, is that I'm always learned that discontinuous phase transitions are trivial and continuous ones are easy. I mean, sorry, yeah, discontinuous ones are trivial and continuous ones are the hard ones. But it's exactly the opposite in terms of their computational complexity classes. So this is a very intriguing thing that no one is really sure how it works. But there have been a lot of workshops going on recently about the intersection of these fields.
Does it just seem to work on a lot of things, or?
It seems to work on a lot of things.
OK, so it hasn't been proven that
no,
it actually solves.
There's no, nothing rigorous about
that would
it.
Be pretty
it's just heuristic. And
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a tremendous amount of theoretical work going on trying to solve KSAT, the phase transition of KSAT. It's been a very active area of research for like 10, 15 years.
So do you know if there are examples for which that algorithm fails?
I don't. But I don't know if there are.
Okay.
And so there have been some very interesting workshops in the last few years trying to get people from these different communities together to talk about the role of disorder, critical phenomena, and computational complexity of algorithms. So I've listed a couple here. Actually, last year in Aspen, last summer, there was a wonderful workshop on complexity disorder and algorithms. The American Institute for Mathematics in Palo Alto held something similar a few years earlier. And then there was a nice semester at MSRI that sort of launched a lot of the interest in trying to understand how to unify these fields. And I'm going to skip that, OK? So I want to go back to real-world networks in the last 10 minutes that I have. And you know, please keep asking me questions. It's great. So I showed you these random graphs. So what does a random graph have to do with reality? We don't really know. So you know, random graphs, there are no correlations. I'm choosing edges at random. Nothing about what already exists. I'm just going through this random process. In real-world systems, we know that there are reasons why edges form. So especially in social systems, we see a lot of triangular structures, which shows transitivity. So if A is friends with B and C end up being friends together. So we see a lot of transitive relationships in real-world systems. And random graphs don't capture them, so they overestimate connectivity. So how to connect random graphs to real-world systems is really an open question. But one of the things that we've seen in real-world systems that sort of launched a lot of physicists getting involved in networks is that there's this extremely broad range of node degrees. So I know I mentioned that at the start, that that was one of the few things that unified all these different networks, was they had a tremendous range of node degrees. So here's an example. This is a social network. It's sort of like Facebook in Budapest. And it's looking at the probability of having k friends versus k. And it's on a log-log scale. So there are many people who have just one friend. So this is the number of friends and the probability of having that many friends. So very, very high probability to have just one friend. But you can see that there are people who have hundreds of friends. So it spans orders of magnitude and ranges. And there was a lot of excitement about things being power laws. When we look more carefully, we find that often they're truncated power laws, so they're power laws with exponential tails, which makes a lot of sense because resources are eventually constrained. You can't grow indefinitely. And we see a lot of places where we get power laws with exponential tails. So I've just drawn a little collection here. So some of them are from biological systems, like protein interaction maps. Some of them are physical systems, like earthquake magnitudes and avalanche sizes. And then these are social systems. They are co-authorship networks amongst physicists, people in the medical professions, and the paper citation network of PNAS.
Great. Co-authors is where the exponentials kicks in.
Yeah. Pretty amazing, huh?
They've got more resources than they.
Yeah. Whereas physicists are several orders of magnitude smaller. And PNAS truncates at 4. So, you know, if you're truncating at 4, are you really a power law? I don't know. I think that's a good question to make, challenge people. So why are power laws interesting? So it's really all about the tail. So I've drawn two pictures, a power law and a Gaussian distribution. So the power laws in blue, Gaussians in black. So if I draw it on a linear scale, the blue one looks kind of dull. It goes down to zero really fast. But if I plot it on a log-log scale, that's where I see that the tail events just tremendously dominate. So that's the thing about power laws, is that the tails go on and they have, so we observe things that are very, very large that we would never see if they were exponentially or Gaussian distributed.
So regarding what you were saying just a minute ago, where you're distinguishing between a power law and a power law with exponent with that eventually transitions to exponential tails, how much confidence can you have in that distinction? Because you're talking about
absolutely, and also any real data set that we have is small,
right?
Very tiny, and there are many distributions that could equally well fit it. So part of the sociology or something, but when some of the initial work was done in 99, people saw power law degree distributions. We were talking about this at lunch, and suddenly everything was a power law. So they measured any network that they could find, the Boston subway system, airline networks, anything they could find, and they said, power law, power laws. But 6 years later, people started actually, the statisticians started coming and attacking the physicists for claiming everything was power laws. And there's been more care put into it, but clearly, when you have finite data sets, we really don't know what to do. And especially because these tail events are so huge, it makes it really hard to use normal statistics. So you can't use like residual sums of square or chi-square distributions because the tails are so tiny that the residuals are really small too.
We can still compare models, right? You've got a power law, strictly power law model, and then an exponential tail model. And I'm wondering, are there any of those cases where you can cite confidence levels?
There are, and there's a beautiful review paper that just came out by Aaron Closet, Cosmo Shalizi, and Mark Newman, and they put it on the archive 2 years ago, and they were talking about power laws and empirical data, and they went through all the data sets that people claimed were power laws and showed that most of them aren't actually power laws. Some of them are truncated power laws. Some of them are not power laws in any way whatsoever. And that paper was under review for 2 years. And then finally it got accepted and is about to appear as a SIAM review. So I imagine it's because many of the referees were these people who kept the papers. So definitely, it's not really clear. The Ergo-Schrendi random graph can't give you power laws. It gives you a binomial distribution, so it looks like a Poisson degree distribution, very concentrated. So we've been trying to come up with other mechanisms for power laws. So one of the most known mechanisms is preferential attachment. I think I have another slide on preferential attachment, but what it tells me is that the rate of growth of something of size s is proportional to its size. Right? So if there was one thing, you would tell me, oh, that's exponential growth, so whatever. But we start out with a collection of things that start out at random points, and we let them evolve this way. And the asymptotic distribution is a power law. So if you have a collection of things starting from random points, going through exponential growth, you end up with power law distributions and their sizes. So the idea of preferential attachment has a nice history. It was introduced by a mathematician who was interested in balls falling into urns, so he's sort of like a statistical physicist. And then Yule was using that to look at genetic diversity, which also shows power law behaviors. It was really popularized by two people in social sciences, Ziff, who looked at distributions of city sizes and showed they had power law behaviors, and Simon, who looked at the distribution of wealth in economies and showed that it also had a power law. And Simon coined this term, the rich get richer, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because if we each put our money in the bank and we're getting the same rate of return, the wealthier people are going to end up with a lot more money than the people who started out with less money because their growth is compounding. So it made a lot of sense from an economic point of view that the rich get richer. And this actually goes way back, so even in the Bible, when you talk about something, sociologists have called the Matthew effect. So long history of preferential attachment. Preferential attachment in networks was actually first observed.
Pareto was 19th century for this.
Pareto, yeah. So he didn't actually see, I mean, the Pareto distribution is the power law is a Pareto distribution. And he was, didn't really say it this crisply because he was looking at wealth of landowners in Italy. And he noticed that 80% of the property was owned by 20% of the people. So he did this 80-20 principle, and if anyone's ever worked in industry, you hear 80-20 all the time. At Microsoft, I work with some product groups, there are always the 80-20 rule, that it takes 80% of your time to finish the last 20% of a project. So preferential attention in networks was first observed by Delisola Price, who was a physicist who, I don't know why, he kind of moved away from physics and started doing history of science. And so he was looking at citation networks of papers. So he spent a lot of time in the library. He's looking at what papers cite other papers, and he found that they had power law degree distribution. And that was published in Science in 65. And then a few, 10 years later, he came up with a generative model about how they could grow based on preferential attachment. So he says that papers gain citation proportional to how many they already have, because you encounter papers that have been cited. So he said that, and it wasn't so well received. It appeared in a more obscure journal in 1967 and was completely forgotten. In 99, Virabhashi and Albert introduced the same model as Delisola Price, but they were thinking about networks in general, not just citation networks. And it launched a lot of the flurry of power laws and preferential attachment that we've seen in the literature. And I love it because it by itself shows this idea of preferential attachment. So if you look at its citation patterns. So back when Simon was thinking about the rich get richer, Mandelbrot had an alternate view. And he thought power laws came from optimization. So he was interested in the statistical structure of language. And he said the goal of language is to optimize how much information is conveyed per unit transmission. So he came up with an argument where he looked at alphabets of characters, how many words there are, what would be the cost of transmitting the words, and the average information per word. So he looked at minimizing the cost per word, and he looked at the distribution of words that would do that, and he found that if words were distributed by power laws, they would optimize how much information could be conveyed per unit transmission. So he really thought that power laws came from optimization. Simon thought power laws came from preferential attachment. And they had a really interesting, very spicy exchange in the journal Information and Control. They had six letters going back and forth, lambasting one another. And then the economist sort of jumped on the rich get richer, and optimization was on hold for many years. But it recently resurfaced. And here's an idea of how to do optimization in a model of network growth. So we're going to start out with a central node, and new nodes are going to arrive. And they're going to try and optimize a trade-off between two things. So a new node arrives, I, and it's going to connect to node J that minimizes some cost function. And here the cost is a combination of two things. It's Euclidean distance from that node and the centrality of that node, so the hop count of that node from the central root. So this guy is hop count 1, this guy is hop count 2, 1, 2. So essentially you want to connect to whoever's closest to you in space that gives you the best network performance. So we're looking at optimizing the trade-off between these two things. And it's a nice idea, but it doesn't actually give rise to power laws. Maybe some of you will see this right now, but from this cost function that I've given you, alpha has a scale in it, right? So this is a dimensionless quantity, so alpha times d is dimensionless, so alpha has units of 1 over dimension. So it ends up not giving you a scale-free power law degree distribution. But inspired by that, some colleagues of mine and I tried to come up with a model that would give us power law degree distribution. So we thought, well, let's start from optimization and we'll get a power law degree distribution. But far more interesting than that, we started out from optimization, and instead of going directly to power laws, we found that optimization could give rise to preferential attachment, which in turn gives rise to these power laws. So that's how sort of how we feel like we've unified these views of Simon and Mandelbrot, who argued at length about the origins, showing that there's actually some underlying foundation that might be the reason that we see preferential attachment at work so often. Makes sense in some social systems, citation systems, but in terms of like the internet, you would never connect to a router that's already heavily loaded. It would give you really poor performance. So we were trying to find out other, we initially thought we would just go from optimization to power laws, but we showed that there's actually some underpinnings to preferential attachment. And I don't think that I'm gonna get into it because we're, I don't wanna go over my time. But we looked at growth in a 1D line. We couldn't even do two dimensions, but we were able to do everything rigorously. So at least we could start with 1D. But we were interested in nodes arriving one at a time and connecting to someone. Actually, I'll just tell you this. Okay, so our model, so nodes are gonna arrive at a unit time, since I was talking about scales. Okay, so they arrive, and we said instead of making alpha be constant, alpha should be a function of what's going on locally. So it's more expensive to, so what we said was let's make alpha be a function of the local density. So it's gonna be more expensive to land in dense areas and less expensive in sparse areas. So what we said, let's make alpha between nodes T and J depend on the density between T and J.
So what's density? It's the number divided by the distance. So when I plug this in back into here, I just end up caring about the number. So I care about how many nodes there are intervening between me and who I might potentially connect to. So I'm trying to minimize the number of transit intervals that I go through. And one of the reasons we were interested in that is that it captures a lot of aspects about the economics of routing on the internet. So when you are in the Perimeter Institute, you know, we have an internet service provider who's giving us service, and they decide how to route our packets. And they have to peer with one another to deliver packets anywhere in the world. And they try, there's a lot of economics about how they make these peering agreements, but you want to minimize how many transit intervals of peers you have to go through because you pay each time you do. So our model, which ended up getting rid of a scale, depends just on transit intervals. And we were able to show how this gives rise to preferential attachment. So here's just an example of how it's growing. And we map it onto the tree. And what we find is that we get preferential attachment. So a node starts getting new attachments, and each attachment ends up giving it a new interval. So each interval initially contributes to it, to its attractiveness. So initially it's going through preferential attachment, but it eventually saturates, and any new interval that is introduced is going to be gained by one of its children. So initially it goes through a period of preferential attachment, which is eventually going to saturate. So we get a modified type of preferential attachment from this, but still preferential attachment nonetheless. And it ends up generating power laws with exponential tails. So those things that I was arguing appear very frequently in nature. So, and we were able to do this rigorously by looking at the degree sequence of the nodes and how it evolves over time, and come up with analytic proofs showing that for less than the saturation parameter, you get a power law. Above the saturation parameter, you get exponential decay. And we were also able to fit some data that nobody had previously about the structure of the autonomous system level of the internet. So we're trying to come up with different cost functions. So we had a very simple thing. It was actually, this is a graphic of what one of the networks looks like. And we were trying to, you know, we have this very specific model. It looks at a 1D line and interval. So we're trying to come up with other things like in biology or in open source software, to get back to what I was talking about initially, we know things are very modular. So modularity is a really good thing, but it can also be detrimental to performance, because the more modular you are, the more you have to invoke modules at runtime. So there's some tension between these two things. So we're wondering if we can come up with an optimization model, sort of looking at the trade-offs between those two things, and many other ideas that we're trying to move forward with in that direction. So like I was saying, there's networks all over the world that we see. Some of them are biological, some of them are social. There's computer networks, there's transportation networks that I didn't even talk about, like the power grid or subway systems. So we see these networks in all these different realms. Some things unify them, some things make them different. We're very broad scale degree distributions. We're trying to understand growth mechanisms that might give rise to them and how their topological features can tell us about their function and control. So, and one of the things that I'm working on right now is actually interactions between all these networks, right? So I know that diseases spread on social networks, but they're abetted by transportation networks that let people hop large physical distances, and hence the viruses that carry hop large physical distances. So we have biological systems spreading on social networks, interacting with transportation networks. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is mathematical models of random graphs that interact with each other and trying to understand how that influences onset of large-scale connectivity. But in conclusion, I hope that I've shown you some interesting stuff about how the interplay of these fields is moving forward. So network science is this something that's been called that for the last 10 years. A lot of people have been doing networks for hundreds of years, not knowing that it was called network science, as a couple of political scientists always like to tell me. So you know, it's relatively new. There's lots of interesting data, many interesting applications, and techniques from physics have been able to make substantial contributions to our understanding about them. I'm personally very interested in phase transitions, looking at how to understand them and also manipulate and control them. So delay or enhance their onset, maybe manipulate their order. So and finally, I think that there's a very fruitful interplay between these four fields. So hopefully I've convinced you of some of these things. Thank you. Thank you.
Can you answer this question? Might just be no. I was wondering, you mentioned locality, things like this, and in some of the fields we're working in, like quantum gravity, we're interested in talking about geometry sort of within the network. So defining ideas like, instead of thinking about the nodes of the lattice being embedded in some space that already exists, we're interested in sort of trying to define some geometry intrinsically, and talking about things like what's the dimensionality of this graph and other concepts like that. And so I was interested, one, if you thought about things like that, and two, if you had any kind of random process which sort of naturally, even though it didn't start with one, gave you a concept of locality, so it gave you either lower order nodes or nodes which were sort of naturally far away from other ones, or some natural sort of lowering of the dimensionality, because in the sort of random graph processes you talked about, you get a very high dimensionality in the intrinsic, like an infinite rate graph.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any sort of ideas.
One of the things I skipped over in that model that we had on the line, it actually ends up being local. So you either connect to your closest neighbor or their parent. So it's nice that it's local in that way too. And one of the things that I've been interested in that's kind of been emerging is thinking about hidden metrics that underlie why these networks might have these structures. So it's dangerous because if it's a hidden metric, you can never observe it. So how will you ever show that this is the mechanism giving rise to it? But with these networks of so everything I've shown you is so simplistic, right? Nodes and edges, they're binary edges, the nodes are all the same. In reality, the nodes have so many different capabilities, and probably not so much if you're thinking about particle systems. But in these networks, there are many different like capacities of routers, edges, etc. So I'm hoping, so there's been some work on hidden metrics that look at how hyperbolic spaces could give rise to power law redistributions. But I would be much more interested in looking at how we can take attributes and make those into hidden metrics, right? So in a social system, you might navigate it by knowing, like, you know, if I'm looking for someone who's an economist, I might try and find everyone I know who's an economist or as close to economics as possible. Or if I'm looking for someone in Washington, I might think about all my acquaintances who live in the Pacific Northwest. So there are all these underlying attributes that can be mapped onto these hidden metrics. So they are, hopefully, there's some potential that they might help us understand these structures from things that are maybe local, but that can't be observed. And what was your second question?
Which way around did I ask them? it was something like, in the random graph process, it doesn't live on any background. What you end up is something which doesn't look very much like a sort of space.
Yeah.
If everything's very close together.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you had any kind of random process which generated something which wasn't
I didn't at all talk about something called small world networks, which are very popular as well. And those are sort of exploiting that idea. So you think about local connectivity, and then with some small probability, you give everybody an opportunity to exchange a local link for a long-range one.
I think what Joe is also, one way of asking the question, there's a background to this, which is causal set theory and cosmology and so on, but I think what he's asking is there some way that you could have what you might call emergent locality?
Uh-huh.
In other words, you start with a set of rules that don't refer in any way to a given metric, hidden or explicit, but somehow as it grows, it develops this kind of spatial structure with respect to which locality makes sense.
I don't know about that, but I mean, you can almost think of like preferential attachment as maybe giving rise to some kind of locality, since everyone tends to connect to that central hub. So if we wanted to say that they had some space underlying them, maybe people migrate and they connect to that hub. So with like city sizes, we can see them going through some kind of preferential attachment, which would give rise to high local concentrations. But that's very interesting.
So I'll mention also that Raisa is going to be here until Friday.
Yeah.
So thank you.